Texas's first openly gay member of Congress.
Knight Barajas, thanks so much for being with us. That does it for our show. Staff writer for the Texas Observer. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now. Thanks for joining us.
The time is 4:59. The KABU Evening News is next after these messages.
KABU Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
You often hear us saying, thank you for donating to KABU, but really, you are donating through KABU. When you donate, you activate hundreds of threads that radiate out from the KABU hub, that reach out into our web of communities. You activate the obvious core, which is our vast menu of programming, but each of those programs reaches an audience, and each of the people in the audience get to hear the message, a message that you helped pay for. That is a lot of people. You may not realize just how profound your donation really is, but the communities do, all of them, and they appreciate it. Invest in the future by supporting us on Kickstarter today. We have 3 days left to make our goal of $20,000. Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter, and thank you for your support of KABU.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, Portland City Commissioners voted unanimously to make permanent a program that requires landlords to pay renters moving costs if they are evicted without cause or need to move because of a rent increase of 10% or more.
Governor Jay Inslee signed a bill yesterday making Washington the third state to ban bump stocks.
The Justice Department sued the state of California over policies that protect undocumented immigrants from deportation.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Wednesday, March 7th, 2018. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. KABU News poet Dan Raphael thinks Donald Trump would be a better weatherman than a president.
Yesterday was 52 and sunny. Daffodils and crocuses popping up everywhere. The clocks change next Sunday. Things are back to normal. February in Greenland was 60 degrees warmer than average. Low snowpacks in the Cascades mean more drought this summer. Trump appointed a former Dow Chemical exec to run the EPA's programs on toxic waste. And in 2 weeks, Cape Town, South Africa won't have enough water to send any to people's houses. Yep, the new not normal. The climate of workplace harassment continues to heat up. Threats of school shootings have increased since Parkland. No one was thinking of world trade till Trump went the wrong way with it. Next, he'll declare air conditioning illegal in sanctuary cities. In fact, Trump is the perfect weatherman. He's wrong even more often than they are. When the TV meteorologist calls for a snowmageddon that doesn't happen, no harm. When Trump rattles his nuclear saber and talks about border walls like pressure fronts, what can I stock up on to get me through a never-ending season of record climate violence and the certainty of disasters like this planet's never seen? For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
Joanne Hardesty, president of the Portland chapter of the NAACP, is stepping down from her position. The resignation comes as she campaigns for a Portland City Council seat for the May election. She initially planned to depart the NAACP at the end of her term in December and decided instead to focus on her campaign. In a press release, she stated, quote, "I have faithfully completed all my duties. However, the reality is that I have made a new commitment to the people of Portland in working to become elected to City Council and to learn and engage in all Portlanders' issues, Right now I am learning. I need to be 100% focused on that mission. Joanne Hardesty was also a longtime host of the KBOO program Voices from the Edge.
This morning, Portland City Commissioners voted unanimously to make permanent a program that requires landlords to pay renters moving costs if they are evicted without cause or need to move because of a rent increase of 10% or more. This bill, created by Commissioner Chloe Daly, was passed last year on a one-year trial. The program includes an array of exemptions that will allow some landlords with a single unit and other landlords meeting certain conditions to avoid paying tenants' relocation costs. Last week, the commissioners heard several hours of testimony, some from tenants saying how much the bill had helped them, and some from landlords complaining about the restrictions. These new rules take effect immediately.
Governor Jay Inslee signed a bill yesterday, making Washington the third state to ban bump stocks. 20 states in all have introduced this kind of legislation. The new law makes it illegal for anyone in Washington to manufacture or to sell bump stocks beginning July 1st. In July of 2019, it will become illegal to own or possess a bump stock anywhere in the state. Last October 1st in Las Vegas, Stephen Paddock used bump stocks to kill 58 people and injure hundreds more.
Last year, the website Greater Portland Pulse launched the Housing Data Hub, making granular data and detailed maps of housing issues available to the public. Greater Portland Pulse is a project of the Institute for Portland Metropolitan Studies, housed on the Portland State University campus. Portland has officially been in a housing crisis since 2015, and unofficially for years before that. Tomorrow morning, Greater Portland Pulse is hosting a media-only event to show media makers how to best use the hub. For more on how the general public can use the hub and the information it presents, KBOO reporter Sam Bowman spoke with Liza Moorhead, one of the primary researchers on the project at the Institute for Portland Metropolitan Studies.
I've been looking at the Housing Data Hub, and it's a pretty remarkable tool. And I was wondering if you could just tell our listeners what they can see on this new website.
Sure. We launched the Housing Data Hub in October of 2017. And it's a website that combines multiple tools for exploring information about housing in our region. So we have a number of indicators where we track data about housing over time, things like the average inventory of houses that are for sale, what affordability looks like for different people, different indicators about housing units that are available in the region. We also have small geography maps on the site. The indicators are a good way of getting a high-level look about what's going on with housing in our region, and then the small geography maps allow us to drill in to specific neighborhoods and cities and get a more of an on-the-ground look at what's happening in terms of the average sale price for housing, new residential development, and a number of different population indicators. In addition to the data in the form of maps and indicators, we also do a lot of our own research. So we have research and data stories on the site about accessory dwelling units in Portland, where we have information about where ADUs are, but also information about policies around them, comparing different cities in the region. Do you need parking for an ADU? What do the SDC fees or what do the development fees look like? We're in the middle right now of a big project where we're looking at missing middle housing, which it refers to units, buildings that are 2 to 20 units in size, and why aren't there more of them being built? So we have been talking to developers and trying to get an idea beyond zoning, why aren't more of these buildings appearing in our neighborhoods, since we do have a housing crisis and we are looking at increasing density in a lot of the cities around the region.
What does the Housing Data Hub add to the conversation around housing in Portland that might not have been there before?
Well, we built the Housing Data Hub after I spent about a year going to different events around town and around the region, talking to people, talking to advocates and policymakers and journalists, people who were looking at housing, and I kept hearing over and over again that people were both overwhelmed by the amount of data that was out there, but also unsure where to find the data that they were looking for. So during that time, I collected people's questions and learned information about their data needs, and then came back and created a website that we hope will be a one-stop place where people can go to get a lot of data about the region that is vetted, reliable, and updated on a regular basis. We've also included links to other related local and regional research and links to national research. So, you know, there's a ton of work being done on housing, both in our region and around the country, and we really want to create a place where people can go to learn as much as they can about what's happening in the region. So we wanted to include other work that we found interesting and reliable on the site.
What's a good example of some of that other work that you have up on there?
Well, when you called, I was adding three new pieces of data from the Law Atlas Project out of Temple University, and these are national maps that look at there are three different ones. There's state landlord-tenant laws. There's also state fair housing protections and nuisance projects or nuisance properties. And so these are websites that you can go to find out more about, for example, fair housing protections in your state and how that varies across the country. So if you have questions about whether you as a tenant are protected in terms of your race, your religion, you can go and learn about the laws in your state on this website.
Where can our listeners find this?
It's at gpphousing.imspdx.org. And I would love to, if people go and look at the site and have any questions or would like more information about anything that is up there, I would love to hear from your listeners. My email address is more@pdx.edu, and I'd love to answer any questions or provide any additional information that people are looking for.
Liza Moorhead with the Housing Data Hub Project at Greater Portland Pulse, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
For KBOO Portland, I'm Sam Bowman.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
With National Native News, I'm Daisha Eaton in for Antonia Gonzalez. The Durango Herald reports that Navajo filmmaker Cody Daish was released on a $25,000 bond Monday after being arrested Saturday following sexual assault allegations. The allegations spur from an incident that occurred at a hotel on Friday while the 29-year-old from Shiprock was in Durango for the Durango Film Festival. He was there showing his short, Spared, a story of two families struggling with violence. The victim, a 24-year-old woman, claimed she was lured to a hotel by Daish through Facebook to model for a photo shoot, where she says he tried forcing her to have sex, locked her in a bathroom, and held her phone. Court records show she called police around 12:30 a.m. She asked that bail remain at the original amount of $250,000. However, a judge released Daish without posting any money. If Daish violates the terms of the bond, he will be taken into custody and could be forced to pay a $25,000 bail. Daish denies that he held the woman captive. He was also arrested on suspicion of false imprisonment in addition to a felony sexual assault charge. Daish has a previous domestic violence battery charge in 2013 in New Mexico. Prosecutors say alcohol was involved in the incident. In addition to the bond, the judge imposed a protection order for the victim, as well as a condition that Daish cannot consume alcohol and will be regularly drug tested. Daish is scheduled to appear in court again on March 16th, where it's expected that he'll face formal charges by prosecutors. A Native organization is working to create opportunities for artist entrepreneurs. First Peoples Fund, which supports artists and culture bearers, provides professional development for tribes, organizations, and community members. Jeremy Staub is program manager with First Peoples Fund. He says learning skills such as marketing, pricing, and photography, and how to use online tools can enhance the Native art business.
It's really great to have the conversation on how to be a better artist as far as a business side of art, but at the same time, it's pointless unless we have the conversation on cultural values and then work with artists and coaching them on growing their arts business and taking it to the next stage, however they determine that, because we all have different different definitions of success in our lives.
Malesio Benali is a Navajo artist who travels to art shows to promote his work. Benali says many artists in Indian country do this type of artistic entrepreneurship and says for an artist to stand out in the crowd, it's important to promote their work.
Pretty much try to be yourself, be unique about your pieces, kind of find your own trademark, just so you're kind of separating yourself from other artists as well, just so you're known out there in the Native art world. And then, of course, at the same time, make sure you have the business cards and all the contact information just in case people do want to add on and such forth and find you in the future if they can't find you at an art show nearby.
Staub says many artists spend a lot of time perfecting their medium, but don't spend enough time learning the business of art, and that's where professional development can come in handy. Staub and Benali are taking part in the National Reservation Economic Summit this week in Las Vegas, where tribal and business leaders across Indian country are receiving training and discussing business opportunities. The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs is launching a tribal outreach effort to encourage Native veterans to apply for disability and pension benefits. Department representatives are traveling to at least 20 tribal communities in 11 states, stretching from Alaska to Oklahoma. VA officials are urging veterans to attend the events to find out whether they're eligible for veterans' pensions or for what are known as presumptive disabilities. Some widows of veterans may also be eligible. The agency is launching the first event on the Navajo Nation March 21st. With National Native News, I'm Daisha Eaton.
President Trump has asked the Pentagon to plan a military parade in Washington, D.C. on Veterans Day, November 11th. Democrats have decried the cost and the authoritarian implication, and anti-war groups are planning a countermarch. Margaret Flowers, medical doctor, Green Party activist, and co-founder of the website Popular Resistance, is among those organizing the countermarch. KPFA's Ann Garrison spoke with Margaret Flowers.
Margaret Flowers, does this countermarch have a name yet, and what can you tell us about the coalition organizing it?
So far, the coalition is just calling this the No Trump Military Parade. Our goals are to mobilize enough people to sign up that President Trump feels a need to cancel his military parade. If that doesn't happen, we hope that we can have enough people come to Washington, D.C., that there will be more people opposing the military parade there than there would be supporters of it. As far as the coalition, this is still fairly young. What we found was that a number of organizations we work with were organizing responses to the military parades. ANSWER put out a strong call for people to show up. Veterans for Peace and some of their allied organizations were organizing a Veterans and Indigenous Peace March during that weekend with a message to reclaim Armistice Day, which is what Veterans Day was initially. Interestingly, this is the 100-year anniversary of Armistice Day, the first Armistice Day, the end of World War I. World Beyond War was getting people to sign on to oppose the parade. So we thought, why don't we bring all these people together and others that we know and see if there might be some opportunities for collaboration and to try to make this a big display of opposition to militarization both at home and abroad. And had our first kind of exploratory call last week and found that there was a lot of energy and a lot of unity in our messaging against U.S. imperialism, militarization, and austerity for public needs. So the people behind the organizing of this are groups who are strongly opposed to the corporate duopoly war parties and who have been working to revive the peace movement in the United States.
Some of those who identify as peace activists will no doubt say that this march is a reaction to Trump, not to the war and weapons production that keep escalating no matter who's in the White House. What's your response?
Now that President Trump is in office, that's the concern because that's what the Democratic Party groups and the party itself do when Republicans are in power. They use these issues for their own ends. You know, it's interesting, and I know that you're aware of this, that the Women's March was not a march against U.S. militarism. The so-called progressive candidates that are running for seats in the Democratic Party, I haven't seen anybody who has a strong anti-militarism platform. So there is the possibility that some of these Democratic Party groups will try to latch on to this effort and use it for their purposes. I think it's important for us who understand that the United States has a long history of militarism, that it has been escalating under several of the most recent presidents. Obama was worse than Bush. Trump is trying to outdo Obama. That it's not a matter of which party is in power. It's that the United States is the largest empire in the world. And we have a very strong military machine that demands to be fed constantly. Our goal is to have our message be as clear as possible and get our message out in front of this. So even if some of those Democratic Party groups sign on, they'll be adding numbers, but hopefully not diluting the message.
And that was Margaret Flowers, peace, justice, and Green Party activist. Flowers said that she and the coalition will also be supporting the Women's March on the Pentagon, now planned for October 20th to 21st, also in Washington, D.C. In Berkeley, for Pacifica, KPFA Radio, I'm Ann Garrison.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a live-streamed edition of News from the Boo, where we'll discuss the final stretch of the Kickstarter campaign. At 6 o'clock, it's Kitchen Table Conversations, followed at 7 by Keeping It Real. Tonight's weather in Portland will be 60% chance of rain with a low of 43. Tomorrow, there'll be an 80% chance of rain with a high of 58, and it'll be breezy with wind gusts up to 31 miles an hour. Today in history, 250 years ago in 1778, Captain James Cook, after discovering the Hawaiian Islands, made the first sighting of what would become Oregon in Yokina Bay. Our quote of the day is from the film director Stanley Kubrick, who died this day in 1999. He said, "If you can talk brilliantly about a problem, it can create the consoling illusion that it has been mastered."
Is Texas turning blue? In yesterday's primary election, Democrats more than doubled their turnout from 2014's primary elections. 1 million Democrats voted, compared with 1.5 million Republicans. The focus of the primary was the candidates for Senate, including Republican incumbent Ted Cruz. Accepting no PAC money, Democratic challenger Beto O'Rourke raised more money than Cruz. Hispanics, who make up 40% of Texas's population, are the key to the election. Despite his close association with Trump's anti-immigrant policies, many Texas Hispanics, including some of those registered as Democrats, continue to support Cruz.
Lawsuits have always been a large part of Donald Trump's business tactics, and he's carried that into the White House. Last night, the Justice Department sued the state of California over its policies that protect undocumented immigrants from deportation. This morning, Attorney General Jeff Sessions told a law enforcement group in Sacramento, "California absolutely, it appears to me, is using every power it has, powers it doesn't have, to frustrate federal law enforcement. So if you can be sure that I'm going to use every power that I have to stop them." In October, Governor Jerry Brown signed into law a bill that prevents police from inquiring about immigration status and curtails law enforcement cooperation with immigration officers. Late last week, acting ICE Director Thomas Homan attacked Oakland's Democratic Mayor Libby Schaaf for warning her residents about impending federal raids.
Another blow against consumers in the Senate yesterday, with 12 Democrats joining the Republicans in voting to end discussion on the Economic Growth, Regulatory Relief, and Consumer Protection Act. Don't take the bill's name literally. It weakens rules upholding key laws protecting consumer lending, financial stability, and the ability of regulators to monitor the country's largest financial institutions. The bill dilutes reporting requirements, enabling regulators to enforce laws prohibiting racial discrimination in lending. It also exempts 25 of the country's biggest banks, including those which received $48 billion in bailout funds after 2008's market meltdown, from enhanced supervisory requirements passed in the wake of that financial crisis. The bipartisan Congressional Budget Office said Monday that this bill would increase the chances that a major financial firm will, quote, fail, or that there will be a financial crisis. The bill is expected to be voted on and approved next week.
And now it's time for Labor History in 2 with Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1974. That was the day that workers at Ferro Manufacturing finally ratified its first contract. Workers went on strike in May of 1972, demanding union recognition. Owner Willie Ferro had said he'd rather die than have his company go union. It was said that he rode his bicycle through the plant screaming, "Work faster! Work faster!" Management had imposed increasingly unattainable production quotas that bred dangerous working conditions until finally the workers had had enough. The organizing drive to bring the American Clothing Workers of America began in 1969. It spread to five plants throughout El Paso, Texas. Workers often met in secret. Though male cutters had initially sought out representation with the ACWA, the workforce was overwhelmingly comprised of Mexican-American women. The workers staged a walkout in March of 1972, and many were fired on the spot. By May of that year, the firing of workers at the San Antonio plant for union activity prompted a strike. Declared an unfair labor practice strike, the AFL-CIO began a national boycott campaign of Ferro products. The ACWA organized public support and strike relief. Women strikers embarked on a nationwide speaking tour as part of the Justice at Ferro Strikers Committee to build the boycott and public support. By early 1974, the NLRB ordered the workers to be reinstated and union organizing to go forward. The contract included wage increases, seniority rights and job security, and grievance procedures. But long-term lessons of the strike proved that the work of organizing could never stop with winning recognition and a first contract. Workers continued to battle for years against quotas, firings, and weak representation in a historically right-to-work state.
And now it's time for a daily climate change report from Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazowitz, and this is Climate Connections. 3 years ago, Sean Kim wanted to find a way to raise awareness about climate change and raise money for nonprofits working on solutions. So, while still in high school, he founded an apparel company called Pacific Peak. He began donating all net profits to an environmental charity.
We started off as a clothing company that made clothing just like any others, through many wholesale sites and stuff. And it was then when we realized how terrible our shirts really were for the environment.
He and his partners learned that the textile industry is a significant cause of carbon pollution, so they began looking for a better source of materials. After raising money through an online fundraising campaign, they developed a line of t-shirts made from recycled cotton and polyester. The cotton is made from fabric scraps and old clothes, and the polyester is created using recycled water bottles. Kim says this reduces carbon pollution and saves 500 gallons of water per shirt. And he says his company helps make sustainability cool.
It's more than just wearing a brand. You're really representing a movement that will hopefully reshape the way teenagers think about environmental issues.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Now here's the newscast dedicated to stories on the changing climate and environment. It's the Green News Report.
These metals are used in energy infrastructure build-out. Higher costs would hurt the energy companies.
Oil and gas industry slams Donald Trump's proposed steel tariffs. Boston hit with historic flooding for second time in a month, with more on the way. Toxic coal ash is contaminating groundwater supplies near coal plants. Plus, plastic pollution has reached all the way up to the Arctic.
All of those fantastic news stories and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
CO2 is a benign gas required for life on Earth, and is not dirty.
Wow. Former coal exec Fred Palmer couldn't say anything dumber.
Coal is not dirty. Coal is green.
I stand corrected. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, the East Coast, specifically Boston, has been getting slammed, and it's going to be getting slammed again in just a day or two.
Yes, it is. Over the weekend, Boston was hit by the second 100-year storm in 1 month. The intense nor'easter left 8 people dead and brought hurricane-force winds and flooding to coastal communities along the northeastern seaboard. The storm surge in Boston was the third highest ever recorded, and that happened just weeks after a previous storm broke downtown Boston's all-time flood record. The Boston Globe connected the climate dots with this double whammy of rising seas and frequent intense storms that increase risks for coastal communities. Quote, "The spectacle of seawater swamping coastal communities once again raised concerns about how these heavily developed areas will endure rising sea levels caused by climate change, a preview of the extreme flooding the city can expect in the years ahead."
In the years ahead, at this point, it's the days ahead.
Indeed. Meanwhile, the oil and gas industry has slammed President Trump's surprise proposal to impose major tariffs on imported steel and aluminum.
Surprise!
Going so far as to call them job-killing tariffs, saying those steel tariffs would increase costs at every stage of operations, from drilling to pipelines to refineries, and would result in higher prices for consumers.
Wow, he's actually going to harm his own base in the oil and gas industries? Is he crazy? Don't answer that.
But it's not just the fossil fuel industry. The American Wind Energy Association also said that the proposed tariffs would increase the cost of wind energy infrastructure projects, particularly costs for domestic wind turbine manufacturers.
Well, that's just a bonus for Trump.
Trump's tariffs also risk a global trade war. European Commission Chief Jean-Claude Juncker did not mince words.
So now we will also impose import tariffs, he said in Hamburg. This is basically a stupid process, the fact that we have to do this, but we have to do it. We'll now impose tariffs on motorcycles, Harley Davidson, on blue jeans, Levi's, on bourbon. We can also do stupid. We also have to be this stupid.
It's turning into World War Stupid.
Meanwhile, coal ash waste is polluting groundwater supplies at coal-fired power plants across the country. Coal ash is the toxic sludge left behind after burning coal for electricity. We make 100 million tons of it a year, and it's often stored in unlined pits. According to a new Associated Press analysis of data released by utilities, groundwater is now contaminated with elevated levels of toxic pollutants like arsenic and radium near more than 70 coal-fired power plants and coal ash disposal sites around the country.
This is going very well.
The AP analysis of groundwater contamination data came out just one day after the Trump EPA announced it plans to weaken regulations on coal ash disposal.
Of course.
Scientists at the National University of Ireland, Galway, have now confirmed that our plastic pollution has reached deep into even the most remote parts of the northern Atlantic Ocean and is affecting marine life. The researchers found 73% of the deep-sea fish that they tested had ingested microplastics, tiny pieces of broken-down plastic found in their stomachs.
This is 73% of the fish all the way up in the Arctic have plastic in them?
Yes.
Wow.
But Mumbai is taking action. India's biggest city is phasing in a ban on most types of single-use plastics, and that includes single-use plastic bags, disposable containers and utensils, and they're starting this month. And finally, Hawaii, a state with a $17 billion tourism industry and a persistent plastic pollution problem on its beaches and in its oceans, is moving to become the very first U.S. state to institute a statewide ban on polystyrene food containers.
Wow. Thank you, Hawaii. For all of those stories and more, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Don't forget, you can download our reports anytime via Stitcher, TuneIn, or iTunes. Find us, follow us, and share us worldwide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Now it's time for a daily newscast presented by Public News Service, the independent news service stationed in 37 states.
The Public News Service daily newscast for Wednesday, March the 7th, 2018. I'm Mike Clifford. Another top Trump advisor heading for the exit. Also on today's Nationwide Rundown, Congress looks to ease up on banks. And we'll tell you why folks in Iowa are focusing this month on seeing me for me. Now, our top story, President Trump's top economic advisor said Tuesday he would resign. The New York Times reports White House officials insisted there was no single factor behind the departure of Gary Cohn, who heads the National Economic Council, but his decision to leave came as he seemed poised to lose an internal struggle over Trump's plan to impose large tariffs on steel and aluminum imports. In a statement to The Times, President Trump said, "Gary's been my chief economic advisor and did a superb job in driving our agenda, helping deliver historic tax cuts and reforms and unleashing the American economy once again." Speaking of economic stories that impact us all, Nevada's Dean Heller, one of 67 U.S. senators to vote Tuesday to start debate on the biggest bank reform bill since the financial crisis of 2008.
Senate Bill 2115, formerly called the Economic Growth Regulatory Relief and Consumer Protection Act, lifts the most stringent regulations, including the so-called stress tests, on banks that have between $50 and $250 billion in assets. The rules were put in place to prevent any future chain reaction meltdowns, such as the ones that led to the recession. Carter Doherty with the nonprofit Americans for Financial Reform says opponents of the reforms Congress passed in 2010 have been gunning for them ever since.
And this is the first time that they've gotten as far as a vote in the Senate. And unfortunately, it was a bipartisan vote.
Doherty says a recent study showed that Wall Street spent more than $2 billion to influence decision makers in Washington during the last presidential election, not counting unreported dark money. The website OpenSecrets.org shows that Senator Heller has taken more than $122,000 from commercial banks in the 2017-2018 election cycle, the fourth highest amount of any U.S. senator. Supporters of the reforms say the Dodd-Frank regulations were an overreaction that cost the banks too much to comply with. I'm Suzanne Potter.
NBC News reports adult film star Stormy Daniels sued President Trump Tuesday, alleging that he never signed a non-disclosure agreement. The civil suit filed in L.A. and obtained by NBC News alleges her agreement not to disclose her, quote, intimate relationship with Trump is not valid because while both Daniels and Trump's attorney signed it, Trump never did. Several universities across Missouri say they will overlook disciplinary actions against any prospective students if they get punished by their high school for participating in next week's national walkout to protest gun violence. More on the story from Tramell Gomes.
The walkout comes a month after 17 people were killed at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. Thousands of students are expected to join their peers across the country in the 17-minute national school walkout on March 14th. If you're a student concerned about a possible blemish on your permanent record for participating, some universities are saying not to worry because they're taking a different approach to peaceful civil protests. Patrick Giblin is a spokesman for Webster University.
We immediately do not see that as a negative mark. In fact, we mark that as a show of leadership on behalf of the students.
Lake Erie can't speak for itself, so dozens of Ohioans will be its voice this week on Capitol Hill. Mary Sherman reports they join hundreds from around the country to promote the importance of programs that keep the Great Lakes healthy and drinking water safe.
There are proposals for massive funding cuts to the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative and Farm Bill conservation programs that help reduce pollution runoff from agriculture. Christy Meyer with the Ohio Environmental Council says the cuts could be detrimental to Lake Erie.
We consistently see a harmful algal bloom in Lake Erie. And so what does that mean for this coming year? We've had a lot of rain, we've had a lot of snowmelt, and we're going to have less funding to be able to put best management practices on these farm fields.
Since 2010, $2.5 billion in Great Lakes restoration funding has allowed more than 3,500 projects in the region to address a range of environmental challenges, improve habitat, and fight aquatic invasive species.
And finally, Roz Brown tells us more than 50 million Americans are living with developmental disabilities, but many are also highly functioning individuals actively participating in their communities.
Lane Till is a spokesperson for the Iowans with Disabilities and Action Project and says this year's campaign theme, See Me For Me, recognizes the contributions made by the 48,000 Iowans with developmental disabilities. She believes the month provides an opportunity to remember that every person deserves to be identified as a unique individual with special gifts and talents.
One of the things that we talk about quite a bit is a person's ability versus their disability. And so March helps us highlight the contributions of those with disabilities in their communities throughout Iowa.
Developmental disabilities are those obtained prior to age 22 that cause mental or physical limitations.
You could follow the stories of Iowans and others across the nation during Developmental Disabilities Awareness Month. The hashtag is DDAAwareness18. That's our news for now. I'm Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
The Israeli parliament recently passed a law that allows the interior minister to strip residency rights from any Palestinian living in Jerusalem if he deems them to be a threat to Israel. It was ratified this morning. Literally, residency can be stripped from any Palestinian who demonstrates or is suspected of a, quote, breach of loyalty with Israel. This applies primarily to the more than 400,000 Palestinians who live in East Jerusalem, which has been directly occupied by Israel since it was seized from Jordan in the 1967 Six-Day War. Palestinians who live there, many of whom were born there, are viewed not as Israeli citizens but as foreign immigrants who are issued permanent residency cards as well as limited Jordanian passports. Deeply conservative Interior Minister Ayesh Deri, quoted by Al Jazeera, said the law would allow him to protect, quote, the security of Israeli citizens. The Israel-based Palestinian rights group Andela condemned the law in a press release, saying it is against international law. They say that Israel's occupation makes Palestinians in East Jerusalem a protected civilian population, and any attempt to force them to profess loyalty to their occupiers is illegal, as would be forcing them from their homes for not doing so.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael and Sam Bowman. The producer is Kyle Carezzi. Our engineer is also Sam Bowman. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, it's a special day of programming for International Women's Day. At 7 o'clock is Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. At 8, it'll be Bread and Roses with host Della Ray, who will be highlighting women artists, athletes, scholars, and innovators. At 9 o'clock on Press Watch, Teresa Mitchell shares her writing on life and work as a trans bus driver in Portland. At 10 o'clock, it's Flashpoints with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock, Yvonne Rivero hosts a special on the epidemic of trafficked women. KBOO's Kickstarter is live. Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter. and help KBOO build a city of media makers. Once again, that's kboo.fm/Kickstarter.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO, with news from your community radio station.
Hello, hello, folks, and welcome to News from the Boo. This is a very, very special edition of News from the Boo because we are streaming live online. So if you are on Kickstarter Live, hello. If you are on Facebook Live, hello. Maybe Instagram. And also if you're listening on the airwaves, hello. I'm Delphine Crescenzo.
Welcome, everybody. I'm Erin.
So Erin, guide us through this.
All right, so we are getting down to the wire here. 2 days left of KBOO's Kickstarter campaign.
Yes.
Ends on Friday.
Yes.
And you are here to talk to us about KBOO's pursuit to build a city of media makers.
I am here, and I'm super excited because we just met our goal.
What?
Did you not know that?
This must have just happened in the last hour.
It really just happened in the last hour, so I want to say thank you to Bill, who has been, it's really amazing because this is community radio. This is like 50 years in the making of KBOO, you know? So this is Bill, one of our volunteers, someone who's been involved on and off at KBOO since 1971. And he said, you know, he's called and he's been thinking about, you know, this. And he said it was coming down to the wire, and he really thinks KBOO is so important. So he just went ahead and supported us all the way to the $20,000 mark. So congratulations, everyone.
Go KBOO. That's fantastic. So what happens now? Does the campaign end, or can people still donate until Friday?
Well, people can still donate until Friday, so two more days. And I really wonder what we can do in two more days. And so I would love to challenge everyone. Can we raise another $5,000, get to $25,000 in another 2 days? Again, we are building a city of media makers, which means that we are really trying to support folks with training and with learning how to share with their community what is happening around our city, what is important for us to really care about and pay attention to.
So dig into that a little bit. When we talk about becoming media makers, what kinds of resources and experiences can people access here at KBOO?
Well, there's a wide variety of different experiences and training and resources that people can access. And the first piece would be really if you are interested in becoming a citizen journalist. If you have thoughts and ideas about what's happening in your community, maybe you have thoughts and ideas about what has happened to you, what's happening to your loved one, to your neighbors, and you're not really hearing on the news, why is it that these folks are having those experiences, you know?